Welcome to the May podcast for Neurosurgical Focus. I'm Natalie Pynchon. The May issue is on the topic of intracerebral hemorrhage, treatment options and outcome. In this podcast, topic editor Dr. David Newell of the Swedish Medical Center in Seattle, Washington, speaks with Dr. Stephen Monteith of Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. They discuss Dr. Monteith and colleagues' article, Transcranial MR-Guided Focused Ultrasound Sonothrombolysis in the Treatment of ICH.
Hello, I'm Dr. David Newell, and I'm the Chief of Neuroscience at the Swedish Neuroscience Institute, and have recently edited this periodical on intracerebral hemorrhage. I have with me today Dr. Stephen Monteith, who will soon to be one of our faculty members at Swedish Neuroscience Institute, who has kindly submitted an article on treatment of intracerebral hemorrhage with a new experimental technology which shows great promise to be introduced into clinical care in the next few years, pending experimental verification and clinical verification of some of the results. I'm going to ask Dr. Monteith to tell us a little bit about this new treatment modality that could be employed for intracerebral hemorrhage called focused ultrasound, and give us a little bit of a history on this and how it came to be that the idea for treating intracerebral hemorrhage and then some of the experimental results came to pass. Dr. Monteith?
Good afternoon, Dr. Newell, and thank you for the opportunity to talk about our work this afternoon. So I guess I'll start off by giving a little bit of background about the concept of sonothrombolysis or using ultrasound to liquefy clots and how it went on and developed into the concept of MRI-guided focused ultrasound. The concept of liquefying clots with ultrasound has been around for quite some time, but there were a lot of issues with the accuracy of the technique, the need for TPA, and so forth, and there's been several trials in the treatment of stroke that are well known, like the Trumby trial and so forth, that have utilized transcranial ultrasound for liquefaction or sonothrombolysis of intra-arterial clot. It was really not until Dr. Sagi Hanoff in Sheba Medical Center in Israel went on and used the focused ultrasound device to explore this concept of liquefying large blood clots transcranially. And I guess taking one step back, just to give a little bit of background about the transcranial device, the way the system works is it's an MRI scanner combined with an ultrasound transducer that's arranged in a helmet configuration, similar to the concept of the Gamma Knife. There are 1,024 ultrasound elements that are arranged in a helmet configuration, and they focus through the skull using degassed water as a medium by which the ultrasound can travel from the machine through the skull and then focus onto a point deep inside the brain. This concept goes back to the Fry brothers in the 50s and 60s, but there were some problems getting through the skull and focusing the beams through the skull because of the aberrations of the irregular aspects of the skull. We've moved on since then, and these focusing problems have been solved, largely due to CT correction algorithms, and we're now able to focus the ultrasound to a focal point within the brain. With the idea of focused ultrasound for sonothrombolysis, it's a mechanical phenomenon. A lot of the work that's been done already for focused ultrasound uses ablation techniques or thermal energy to heat up a small area in the brain with MRI guidance with extreme accuracy in the order of less than 1 millimeter of error, and that uses a thermal phenomenon. But what we found with sonothrombolysis for clots for intracerebral hemorrhage is it's a mechanical phenomenon, so the heating that's involved is actually minimal. And so essentially the technique is this helmet-like device is placed over the patient, and then degassed water circulates around the scalp, and the ultrasound waves travel through the water, through the skin and the bone, and then focus onto a point inside the intracerebral hemorrhage in the brain. And we're able to do this under real-time MRI guidance, so we can see exactly where the ultrasound energy is being deposited. And what we've found in our experimental data is that we can see that the clot is liquefied by an increase in the T2 signal on the MRI scan.
So, Dr. Monteith, this technology wasn't specifically developed for intracerebral hemorrhage, but this may be one of the many uses of this new technology?
That's correct. The technology so far has been utilized mostly for functional disorders. Initial trials for the treatment of brain tumors began at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, and there's a trial for metastatic brain tumors and gliomas, which is ongoing. But really, so far, about 80 patients worldwide have been treated for functional disorders, mostly neuropathic pain, essential tremor with Dr. Elias at the University of Virginia, and also Parkinson's disease have been treated. I believe one or two patients have been treated for OCD as well.
So the intracerebral hemorrhage application was something that came on later just due to somebody thinking of some novel applications of this technology?
That's right. So the team, the Incitec team that developed the device, we're working in Israel on a multitude of applications for this device, and they found that they were able to liquefy clots in simple in vitro bench models. And then Dr. Harnoff and his team went on and were able to go through the skull and liquefy formed blood clots, and then went on and did some more work with animals as well, with an in vivo model of intracerebral hemorrhage.
So it sounds like this technology may be advantageous for deep intracerebral hemorrhages, since it appears that they're aspirated with a minimally invasive technology after the sonication liquefies the hemorrhage. So it seems that in contrast to surgery, which may be more beneficial for peripherally located clots, this could be ideal for deeply located clots, it sounds like.
That's right. So the transducer works best in the middle of the head, and that's why the functional applications are so appealing. For us, with intracerebral hemorrhage clots in the middle of the head, we get maximal efficiency of the transducer because there's less beam shaping that has to occur of the ultrasound waves. And so intraventricular hemorrhage or centrally located clot, in our experience in the lab, seem to have the best result. And in terms of the minimally invasive aspiration, we were able to do it through a 1 centimeter incision with a 2 millimeter aspiration needle. So once the clot's been liquefied, it really is kind of like chronic subdural fluid for those that are familiar. It's just very dark, very liquid. It never reclots, and it's easily aspirated through a small needle.
So how long would it take to perform a sonication on a patient with a typical hemorrhage? I mean, we wouldn't consider evacuating them normally if they were under 10 or 15 cc's, but maybe for deep hemorrhages a little bit smaller size. But how long would it take to, say, sonicate a 20 to 30 cc hemorrhage that you were wanting to aspirate?
So what we found is that each sonication is about 20 seconds, 20 to 30 seconds, and we can get good efficiency with that. And in order to get through a volume, we did volumes up to 60 cc's in cadaveric models. And you could get through that entire volume in a couple of hours. Probably a lot of that was the learning curve in terms of we were still learning how to do the technique. So perhaps, you know, with experience, an hour or so, and we could get enough liquefaction of 80% of the clot or so, leaving a rind of safety around the outside of it, particularly near the lenticular striates, would probably be the initial method first up. So maybe an hour or so.
Mm-hmm. And what are your thoughts on the potential for rebleeding in this type of treatment?
Well, one of the things that would be beneficial is that we don't have to use TPA. A lot of the minimally invasive techniques that are being reported now do use thrombolytics to enhance the dissolution of the clot. We don't require that with this technology, and so I think a safety margin could be left around the area where we think the hemorrhages come from, namely the lenticular striate branches of the MCA in the case of hypertensive hemorrhage, and we would just stay away from that region. So we would be optimistic that we wouldn't have too much in the way of rehemorrhage if we were relatively conservative in our approach or treatment strategy to this problem.
So it is appealing to reduce the clot burden and then reduce the subsequent edema that forms around deep hemorrhages, particularly thalamic hemorrhages and hemorrhages in a central location.
Absolutely, and that's the goal, of course, is to get in there as soon as we can before that 24 hours, 48 hours where the edema starts to pick up, and to minimize the amount of edema that's formed from a large clot burden. Another benefit, I guess, is that we don't have to leave anything in there. We don't have to leave in a drainage catheter or infuse TPA or anything like this, so it's essentially an immediate treatment. We get immediate feedback with the MRI scan. We know exactly what's done, how much we've achieved, and if we're happy, then we can finish the procedure at that point.
Yes, I noticed that Dr. Hanley has recently reported at the International Stroke Conference that perhaps minimally invasive therapy shows an advantage over conservative therapy, but the results may not be appreciated until you follow the patients up for a long term, where it appears we have preliminary information anyway at this stage that the treated patients with clot evacuation may do better than the ones that have been treated conservatively if you assess them at a later period of time, later than 30 to 60 days, notably 3, 6, 9, and 12 months after the event has occurred.
Right. In the setting of a clinical trial, we would have to follow those patients out for a similar period of time. The results may or may not be seen immediately, but I think we'd only know that information after a clinical trial.
Now, is this frequency used for this and the apparatus used for this the same as one used for treating essential tremor and Parkinson's tremor?
No. So this is a slightly different device. It's a 230 kilohertz system, whereas the system that's used for the essential tremor and Parkinson's disease and functional applications is a 650 kilohertz device. Now, what that does is it means that we have a much larger treatment envelope or area of the brain that can be treated. There's less aberration using a lower frequency device than a higher frequency device.
I see. And are there any differences in applying the apparatus to the head?
No, it's a standard technique that we use with both devices. So we use a Lexel frame, which is applied just in the standard way. We do have to shave the hair at the moment. That's something that is being worked on, and that may be less of a problem, particularly with the lower frequency devices, as that may be able to be worked around. And we just apply the frame as you would normally for a stereotactic functional case, and then the patient would be placed in the transducer, and we apply the diaphragm around the scalp and fill the transducer with water, and that's our ultrasound medium to pass the ultrasound from the device through the scalp.
I see. The experimental work has been done in animals. It's been done in cadavers. Is it ready for human trials at this time?
We believe so. We've done a lot of feasibility work with the in vitro testing and the cadaveric model that we developed to specifically test using focused ultrasound. And we had good results with that, and we did safety studies as well, which didn't show any significant thermal injury or blood-brain barrier breakdown or any effects that would be concerning. Using ultrasound parameters that were effective for sonothrombolysis, they were safe and tolerable to the brain. Obviously, we wouldn't target the normal brain parenchyma itself. We'd be targeting the clot adjacent to that, but as a safety margin, we use those parameters on normal brain as well, and there was no untoward effect. So in our view, we're looking to move this forward and test this technology in a pilot clinical study.
So what stage is focused ultrasound at in the U.S. in terms of for clinical trials use?
Right now, there's a clinical trial ongoing for essential tremor. That's a multi-center study. There is a brain tumor trial, which is ongoing as well for metastatic lesions and gliomas. And there's also pilot study work going on for Parkinson's disease with Dr. Elias at the University of Virginia as well.
I see. So this is an extension of some of the methodology that can be used for minimally invasive treatment, which seems to confer an advantage to patients if they're followed long enough, as evidenced by the initial data collected. And I understand a multi-center trial is being planned in the future at this time, a minimally invasive surgery trial with catheter insertion and TPA.
That's right, and this seems to be the natural progression of the whole concept of minimally invasive to minimalist invasive. The catheter-based approaches, as you've mentioned, seem to confer some benefit when the patients are followed up long enough, assuming the catheter is placed along the axis of the clot and there's no problems with the insertion of the catheter, then the TPA seems to be effective. Of course, there are the risks involved of placing the catheter in if the catheter is not perfectly placed, or if the TPA can cause a hemorrhage adjacent to the tract. one of the issues, I guess, you have with the TPA method is the catheter has to be along the long axis of the clot, and sometimes that's not always possible to position the catheter in a perfect location along a long axis, particularly if the clot is very irregular. One of the benefits we have with the MR-guided focused ultrasound system is that the shape of the clot is essentially irrelevant to the device. It can target anywhere we put a sonication spot, and the shape of that, it doesn't matter. Once the clot's all liquefied, it's easy to aspirate the clot regardless of what the original shape of the clot was.
Now, can you tell on the MRI scan whether the clot's been liquefied or not?
Yes, you can. There is an obvious T2 signal increase, and we've published on that because that was the first thing that we had to figure out. The big concern was, how do we know we've done what we set out to do? And there was concern over treatment effect and monitoring of that throughout the procedure. Particularly in the setting of intraventricular hemorrhage, it's very obvious because the CSF tends to fill those portions of the clot that have been liquefied, and so there's areas that have been kind of eaten out of the clot that are very obvious to see because they fill with CSF. In the setting of intracerebral hemorrhage, there is a noticeable T2 signal increase that we can follow after each sonication, and we can see exactly how much we've liquefied, and when we're satisfied we've liquefied enough to decompress and remove that edematous stimulus, then we can stop.
Now, would it be necessary to put a thrombostatic compound into the cavity following the clot evacuation?
That's not something that we have tried with our in vivo studies. We haven't found the necessity to do that, but that's something that could be considered if there were issues with that. I think initially we would be conservative in the amount of hemorrhage that we would wish to evacuate, but certainly the introduction of thrombostatic compounds could be done, and of course it would be done under MRI guidance, so you'd know exactly where it was going.
Is there any requirement for washing it out, or is it just simple aspiration?
Simple aspiration is what we have done so far. Irrigating out could be done as well, using the same principles we use in the operating room, just to rinse out any residual hematoma. That could be another treatment method, particularly in the setting of intraventricular hemorrhage. That would be sort of the natural way in which the clot would be evacuated anyway, with a ventricular drain that's placed in these patients anyway.
So for a patient with an intraventricular hemorrhage and a ventricular drain in, you just have to do the sonication then and not the aspiration?
That's correct. And we've done studies that have demonstrated that the clot, actually, if there's clot within the catheter itself, that we're able to liquefy the clot within the catheter without untoward effect as well, which has implications for catheters that are blocked and so forth, which is a common problem in patients with casted ventricles.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like this could be an exciting new technology with a variety of applications in neurosurgery, and we look forward to hearing about some initial planned studies to be done in humans to verify that the technique may be beneficial.
We're optimistic about it too, and we hope to be moving forward with the clinical trial soon.
Well, thank you, Dr. Monteith. This is Dr. David Newell signing off, and appreciate the opportunity to bring the readership up to speed on this exciting new technology.
And thanks once again to Dr. Jane and the Journal of Neurosurgery for the opportunity to do the podcast, and thanks, Dr. Newell, for your time. Thank you.
This concludes our podcast for the May issue of Neurosurgical Focus. Thank you for listening. Please join us for the June issue, when the topic will be epilepsy. Thank you for listening. JNSPG podcast content is now contained in the newly launched American Association of Neurological Surgeons iTunes U site. Sign up in iTunes for our podcasts and additional content, including video content and podcasts from the AANS, all updated continuously. To read all the articles published by the Journal of Neurosurgery this week, or to listen to more podcasts, please visit us at www.thejns.org. You can also follow the Journal of Neurosurgery Publishing Group on Twitter, and now also on Facebook.